So when I came to Philadelphia, which is a great fight town, I figured, well, you know, hopefully I'll get a chance to cover some boxing. And if Russell had a show that was running on, you know, like on Friday night or something like that, and he would go, "Oh, Bernie, nobody wants to read about De La Hoya or Tyson. They want to hear read about my show." It was like a feeding frenzy, you know, for the people that were there. We were just so fortunate that we were in on the biggest story in boxing in years, you know, and you know, to be there and to be a part of something that was historic and very few other people were there for.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still get goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beaten me. He's won it for you back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, this week I'm joined by veteran Philadelphia fight scribe Bernard Fernandez. Bernard has been covering the sport since the early 80s, and he's been up close and personal with the likes of Oscar De La Hoya, Bernard Hopkins, obviously coming from Philadelphia, Mike Tyson, Lennox Lewis, Riddick Bowe, Roy Jones, and countless others. He was there at Meldrick Taylor's fight with Julio Cesar Chavez the first time round, and he was also in Tokyo when Mike Tyson was stunned by James Buster Douglas. He's an International Boxing Hall of Famer. He was inducted. He was due to be in the class of 2020, but due to the pandemic, the induction ceremonies have been postponed. And in fact, three years worth of inductees will go in next June instead. So not this June, but next June in a bumper International Boxing Hall of Fame weekend. It was great to chat to Bernard, who I spoke to for my recent book or for my new book, Damage. And who I last saw in person when we were ringside at Artur Beterbiev's brilliant fight against Vozdic in Philadelphia. That was a couple of years ago. A reminder before we get to Bernard, this podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance. They're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's the International Boxing Hall of Famer, Bernard Fernandez.
First and foremost, I mean, Boxing Hall of Famer, congratulations. When you set out on the journey all those years ago, I suppose, well, Canastota wasn't even a thing in terms of it being a boxing village. I stand corrected because obviously Carmen Basilio and Dickie D, Veronica and Billy Backus and those guys. But it can't have been on your radar as a destination.
Well, you know, my father, my late father, was a pro welterweight, had a brief career, and his favorite fighter was Carmen Basilio. So when, you know, and I'm not as young as Frank. I'm 73, but I remember the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports, the Friday night fights. And so we would watch those on our old Philco TV, black and white. And whenever Carmen Basilio fought, and the fighters fought a lot more often then, you know, and he was always introduced as being from Canastota, New York, and the onion farmer and all like that. So I had it bouncing around in my head, I guess, in the late 1950s, I'd like to find out about that Canastota place, you know? I mean, who knew, you know, that it would lead to where it led?
Yeah, of course. And, I mean, so your dad, I knew that he dabbled in boxing, but I didn't realize he'd gone pro.
Yeah, actually, you know, matter of fact, I'm here in my home office, and it's over here. You can't see it, but my proudest possession, which will be joined by the ring from the International Boxing Hall of Fame, whenever I get it, is a poster with the main event is Archie Moore in big letters, and Jack Fernandez, my dad's name, in the semifinal wind-up just underneath his, you know, and That's kind of a cool thing to have, you know, and one of my sons will wind up with that, you know, down the road, you know, but, so I always kind of linked, my dad with Archie Moore. And I asked him, I said, you know, how well did you know Archie Moore? He said, you know, when Archie was, you know, when I fought on that, on those undercar, you know, with, Archie Moore, Archie was getting his hands taped when I was fighting. So we weren't exactly bumping into each other that much, you know?
Sure. Was your dad good?
Well, he, you know, I got an old clipping here, and, he's been described, he would have played in Philadelphia because it's a left hook specialist. And another one, lists him as a wild hooking little slugger, you know? So I figured if he was a left hook guy, he would have played well in Philadelphia, you know, but he was from New Orleans, and as am I, you know, and, but I've been in Philadelphia for 36 years. So I like to think that I have one foot in New Orleans and one foot in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so that's where I was going, really. You were born in New Orleans, even though I've always known you as a Philly guy. So, but you also cut your teeth as a copy guy in New Orleans, am I right?
Yeah, you know, Whitey Esnault, you know, was trained Willie Pastrano and Ralph Dupas, and we would go to amateur shows at St. Mary's Italian Gym, and you know, be around those guys, I would go to fights, Municipal Auditorium, to see people like Percy Pugh and Jerry Pellegrini. Henry Hank from Detroit fought in New Orleans many times. I thought he was from New Orleans. He fought there so often, but he was from Detroit. And I was, you know, I think I was the only kid in my fifth grade class at St. Stephen's School, you know, who idolized Carmen Basilio. Everybody else was like into Mickey Mantle, you know, so when I came to Philadelphia, which is a great fight town, I figured, well, you know, hopefully I'll get a chance to cover some boxing. We had a very good boxing writer, Elmer Smith, but then when they switched beats around it at, you know, in 1987, I wound up going to the executive sports editor and said, what are you considering for me? He said, well, you know, maybe the Flyers, that's the hockey team, or the Eagles, which is, you know, the top of the food chain, NFL. And I said, what about boxing? He said, you want boxing? I said, yeah. He said, you got it. And the first fight that I covered for the Philadelphia Daily News, was kind of a decent fight. It was Hagler Leonard, you know, and you know, so there I am at Caesar's Palace, I just said, well, I'm home, you know, and the funny thing is, all the years that I was at the Philadelphia Daily News, there were several times when they changed beats around and they never took me off boxing. I guess they figured nobody liked it as much as I did, and you know, nobody wanted to do it as much as I did, and so I just stayed on it. And even after my retirement from the Daily News in 2012, I've continued to do stuff for Ring TV, SweetScience.com. You know, anybody will have my stuff, you know. I mean, I still enjoy doing it, and you know, hopefully I do it reasonably well.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think you have a Hall of Fame plaque. That, you haven't actually seen your Hall of Fame plaque yet, have you?
No, I haven't. You know,
we're not saying the Hall of Fame's doing you dirty. It's just obviously because of COVID, you haven't been up for your induction and everything yet.
No, I mean, it keeps getting postponed, you know. I know I have a plaque there, you know, and I know my bio is on the website, but you know, it's sort of like, it's like a place, it's like a really good vacation site, you know, that I would like to see, but I haven't been there yet. Actually, I've been to Canastota for many, many Hall of Fame inductions. And really, I never actually anticipated that was going to happen for me. You know, I know they had an observer category, but, you know, I was as surprised as anybody could be when I got the call from Ed Brophy, you know, on December of, I guess, 2019.
So what was your first job in journalism?
My first job in journalism. Well, let's see. If you really want to go back far enough, when I was the summer between my junior and senior year of high school, I snagged a position as the copy boy in the sports department of the New Orleans Times-Picayune, my hometown paper. And I did a couple of American Legion baseball games that had bylines. The stories were about that long. And I was thrilled to death. And then I went to LSU and studied journalism. But my first full-time job in journalism was as the 22-year-old sports editor of the Houma Courier, which is a town about 40-something thousand people, about 45 miles southwest of New Orleans. And one of the sports writers who was old enough to be my father nicknamed me the Boy Wonder. It made me feel like Robin, you know. But I was there for several years. I went to the Miami Herald, the Jackson Daily News in Jackson, Mississippi, then to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and eventually to Philadelphia, which was you know, the job that was most like home. When I went to Philadelphia, I was on one of the great sports staffs in America, one of the best ever. And I was with all these guys who are in their own sports halls of fame. It felt like I was with, you know, the Michael Jordan Bulls or the Babe Ruth Yankees, being on with that group of sports writers. You know, I mean, they were all so wonderful, you know, and so great. And it was just a privilege to be on that staff.
Okay. So at what point, was it only when you got to Philadelphia where you thought, hang on, I've got this passion for sports writing, I grew up loving Carmen Basilio, let's put the two together and do the boxing? Or did that come beforehand?
Oh, no. I mean, the thing is that when I went to Philadelphia, I kind of had it in the back of my mind, you know, that if the boxing beat ever came open, I would ask for it. And it did. And I did ask for it. So they said, okay, you want to go out to Las Vegas for you know, Hagler Leonard? I said, well, yeah, you know, and I went. It took me a lot of places. I mean, boxing took me to Japan. I was there for Tyson Douglas, ringside, you know, not a bad gig. South Korea to the United Kingdom, to Mexico, to Canada, to many sites in the United States. My standing joke was that I spent so much time in Las Vegas that I was there more often than Wayne Newton, you know, I was going out 7-8 times a year, you know, and it was great. You know, I mean, I did two seasons where I covered the Philadelphia 76ers, the NBA team, and I did a lot of seasons where I did Penn State football, which is kind of a major thing. But one time I remember there was a Roy Jones fight that was on the same night as Penn State playing Ohio State. And that was tough. And he says, which one you want to go to? I said, well, I'll go to the Roy Jones fight. And which was okay, because somebody else, you know, pulled down the Penn State Ohio State game, you know, and that had 100,000 people there, you know. But I always felt like boxing was my first love. And as many people who knew me for doing Penn State or for, you know, for the 76ers or General Simon stuff, more people knew me for boxing. I tell you what, if that's what people know me for, I'm fine with that. You know, I mean, that's what I asked for. That's what I got. And look where it led me. Led me to Canastota. You know, I'll get there. Hopefully in 2022, and I'll get the ring that I've been waiting for 2 years, you know, but we'll see.
I know, obviously, that Hagler-Leonard fight was the last fight of Marvin's career, but did the fact that you came from Philly, or were covering the fights for Philly, did that put you in Marvin's good graces at all?
Yeah, you know, Marvin had history in Philadelphia.
Sure.
You know, because, you know, the Petronellis, they wanted to raise his level of competition. So Goody said, we'll take you to Philadelphia, you know, and you can face the Iron. They called, you know, those Philadelphia middleweights the Iron, you know, like he was going to go into the Crucible. And, you know, he lost a bad decision, you know, a hometown decision to Bobby Boogaloo Watts. He had another decision, which he actually did lose that fight to Willie the Worm Monroe. But he came to Philadelphia several times, fought those Philadelphia fighters several times. A lot of people forget that in the mid-1970s, according to Ring Magazine, four of the top 10 middleweights in the world were from Philadelphia. I mean, what are the odds that four of the top 10 ranked middleweights in the world were all from the same city? You know, not only Boogaloo Watts and Willie the Worm Monroe, but Benny Briscoe and, Cyclone Hart. Yeah, and then you also had Kitten Hayward, you know, which was one weight division down, but occasionally fought at middle, you know. So that was an incredible period. I would have loved to have been in Philadelphia then, because Russell Peltz was doing fights at the Spectrum, where they were putting 12,000-15,000 people in there, you know, on a regular basis. And he did it by having these guys fight each other, you know. And so when you had those guys, you know, fight one another, I mean, people just flocked. I mean, it was like neighborhood fights, you know, the North Philadelphia guy against the South Philadelphia guy. And they also were bringing in people like Marvin and Billy Dynamite Douglas, and you know, and it was a great thing. Of course, the Spectrum fights ended when Atlantic City opened casinos in 1978, and then, you know, a lot of those big fights started going to Atlantic City and to Boardwalk Hall, you know, and that kind of killed Philadelphia as a site for those major fights. But I would have loved to have been there then, you know.
And it's ironic, really, that a Philadelphia fighter led the charge to Atlantic City, because it was Matthew Saar Muhammad fighting John Conte that opened the floodgates in Atlantic City, really, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is that I heard people, you know, say later on that, you know, that they would be talking about Arturo Gatti, and they said, Arturo Gatti, you know, Matthew Saar Muhammad was the black Arturo Gatti. And I said, no, you got it wrong. I mean, he came in Matthew's footsteps rather than the other way around. Because if you're putting together a list of like the top 10 action fighters of all time, I don't know if Matthew would be number one, but I tell you what, there wouldn't be many names called before his. You know, I mean, how many of those of his fights were like epic? You know, I mean, if you saw a Matthew Saar Muhammad fight during his heyday, you were going to be a boxing fan for life, you know, because, I mean, I'm looking at this list, John Conte, you know, Yaki Lopez, Lottie Mwale, you know, Kerry the Bull Martin, Murray Sutherland. These were classic fights. I mean, you know, if you were going to have a collection of boxing tapes, you'd want all those fights and you'd watch them over and over. He was that exciting, you know, and, it was my privilege. I wasn't in Philadelphia to see him during his heyday. And the only fight that I covered of his live was on February 26, 1991. He fought Ed Mack at the National Guard Armor, and he lost 8-round decision. But like a lot of fighters, he stayed too long at the fair. You know, you look at his record, 39-16-3, 29 knockouts, and it you know, it doesn't leap out at you. But he was 1-7-1 in his last 9 fights, 7-12-1 in his last 20. And clearly, he should have retired earlier than he did, but boxing is what he knew, and boxing was where he made his living. And as we all know, he was not good with money. You know, he did not prepare for a rainy day, and he wound up homeless, and, you know, but he was a good guy, you know. And the amazing thing about it is that all the wars that he was in, he was a handsome guy, even to the end. You know, you looked at him and he didn't look like he didn't look like Carmen Basilio. You know, yeah. I mean, he didn't have all that scar tissue. And he must have had great skin, you know, because he didn't get all cut up and beat up or anything to the point that, he did get beat up. It didn't show on his face. You know, he was a handsome man, even at the end, you know, which is amazing to me that the wear and tear of his profession did not show on his face.
Well, there was talk. There was a lot of talk at one time when it looked like he was going to leave boxing back in, I think, 82, 83, that he was going to go into either the movies or full-time modeling.
Yeah, one of the things that you probably heard this story before, was that for Rocky III, he was one of the people being discussed for the role of Clubber Lang. And I've also heard, you know, that Ernie Shavers was mentioned, and you know, everybody's heard the story about that Ernie Shavers came in for a screen test with Stallone, and they were supposedly doing some boxing moves, and Ernie Shavers hit Stallone to the ribs, and he was going, like, he said, "Get that guy out of here." And what I was told by Saad, you know, was that he was not considered as much as he might have been for the role, because they wanted him to shave his head, which he didn't want to do. And of course, he was supposed to lose the climactic fight. He said, "No," he says, "I don't mind doing a role, but I got to win," you know. And so that wasn't going to happen, you know. And so we wound up with Mr. T, you know. I guess that wasn't so bad.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, God knows what would have, if Matthew would have been able to open any more doors in acting if he'd taken that. I suppose one of your first things, Bernard, when you got to the Philadelphia boxing beat, was to break bread with Russell Peltz, because he was the doorway to, obviously, the history of Philadelphia, and obviously still a very active promoter back then.
Yeah, you know, and for my third anthology, my second one is going to be coming up probably in the next month and a half or so, but the third one will probably be in the spring of 2022. Championship Rounds Volume 3, Championship Rounds Volume 2 is out shortly. The original book came out in April of 2020. I should have come up with more clever titles for the follow-ups. But you know, covering boxing in Philadelphia, you had to have a lot of dealings with Russell. And the funny thing about it was that when I would do a boxing column or something, you know, I was writing stuff about Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, Riddick Bowe, Lennox Lewis, Ray Leonard, you know. And if Russell had a show that was running on you know, like on Friday night or something like that, and he would go, "Oh, Bernie, nobody wants to read about De La Hoya or Tyson. They want to read about my show, you know?" And I say, "Yeah, okay, all right." And like most promoters, Russell's idea of what was good for boxing, what was good for him, in that respect, in a Philadelphia sense, he was not unlike Don King or you know, Bob Arum, you know, I mean, what's best for him, what was best for boxing. But I tell you what, Russell was a major plus in Philadelphia, because there's been a lot of promoters or would-be promoters that wanted to steal some of his turf, you know, or infringe upon it. And they never lasted. You know, somebody would come in and they would try to challenge him. And why didn't they succeed? Because they would always have their house fighters, and they would feed their house fighters like designated victims. And Russell said, "If you want to succeed in this business, you give fans real fights being competitive fights." And not everybody understands that. And a lot of people in this business, they still have the house fighters, and they keep feeding them fall down guys, you know, and they don't understand why their shows don't sell. You got to give him real fights.
Well, Russell's always said he wants to know what he's got. And the only way you can know what you got is by putting them in.
Oh, yeah, and Russell's a smart guy. I remember one time I covered a fight card at the Philadelphia Civic Center, and he had a fill-in opponent for Buttons Kearney. Hugh Buttons Kearney was one of his house fighters, you know, and a pretty good fighter. And he brought in Jorge Maisonet, who's a Puerto Rican fighter from New York City. He didn't know much about him, and Maisonet knocked out Kearney in the first round. And so he said, well, this guy looks like, you know, he could be something. So he brought him back a second time, and he knocked out another guy in the first round. And all of a sudden, Russell signs him. He starts promoting him heavily in the Hispanic community in Philadelphia, and they build him as the one round man, you know. And he rode Jorge Maisonet all the way to a world title shot against Simon Brown in Budapest, Hungary, you know. A lot of times something falls in your lap, and when it does, you know, the good promoters know how to you know, to take advantage of it. And Russell is a good promoter. He's a Hall of Fame promoter. I mean, he's in Canastota too.
You say that obviously there's been sort of a few hostile takeover attempts maybe of Russell's territory. I mean, there has literally, like, his offices got firebombed, didn't they?
His office did get firebombed, you know, and I wanted to talk to him at some length on one of the anniversaries, and he didn't want to talk about it. I mean, you know, the thing is, you can replace office furniture or a desk or whatever, but he has lots of boxing memorabilia, and not all of it got destroyed, but some of it did, you know. And I'm thinking how I would feel if my Archie Moore poster with my dad's name underneath his, if something happened to it, I would not be happy at all. But you know, he had some really terrific boxing memorabilia that get burnt up in, you know, in the fire, you know, which fortunately did not consume the entire office.
You mentioned about being in Japan for Tyson Douglas. I mean, you were one of the few, because so many people didn't bother to send journalists because obviously it was going to be a whitewash and Douglas was going to fall over in a minute and 30 seconds. In fact, it was Ed Schuyler from the Associated Press who said, how long are you going to be in Japan for? He said about 2 minutes.
Tyson had gone to Tokyo once before for, you know, fight against Tony Tubbs, and that lasted about 2 minutes. And so I remember being in Atlantic City, I'm trying to think who it was. I think it might have been a Vinny Pazienza fight, but so people were saying, I can't believe your paper is going to spend all that money to send you to Japan for a fight that's going to be over in like a minute and a half, you know? And my response was, and what I had told my executive sports editor, I said, you know, if you cover basketball and, you know, it's the NBA finals and Michael Jordan's playing, you're going to go because he's Michael Jordan. Same thing, you know, like in golf. You know, if you were a golf writer and you know, you were going to go where Tiger Woods would play. And in boxing, you know, there was Muhammad Ali, you know, and you know, some other fighters not quite on that level. But Mike Tyson was his Muhammad Ali, you know. Angelo Dundee told me about Muhammad Ali. He said, you know, if he had fought on the dark side of the moon, there would have been fans and boxing writers who would be chartering rocket ships to go to the moon. And so our response was, you know, if Mike Tyson is fighting in Japan, then we're going to Japan, you know. And I went, the Philadelphia Inquirer, our competing paper in Philadelphia, their approach was, well, you know, that's going to be nothing. It's going to be over in a minute and a half. And I went there, biggest upset in boxing history. Then they pulled the thing where they were going to try to, you know, say that it was not a victory for Buster Douglas, that Tyson had knocked out Buster Douglas before the other way around, and there's a big controversy. And so I'm sitting there, and everybody else is trying to, who didn't go to Japan, are trying to cover it from thousands of miles away by telephone, you know. And I was right there, and it, you know, it was like a feeding frenzy, you know, for the people that were there. We were just so fortunate that we were in on the biggest story in boxing in years, you know, and you know, to be there and to be a part of something that was historic and very few other people were there for. Matter of fact, you will appreciate this. They had probably as many British writers for, you know, boxing writers there as they did American writers.
Yeah, I believe that. What was your, you know, obviously, you know, it's all very well to sound very wise after the event, but when you went out there, you kind of had to have thought, you know, this is, you know, I'm not going to be working much, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, maybe just get a couple of lines from Tyson if he's playing ball, don't really need to worry too much about the other fella. And then, you know, I'm going to have, you know, 2 minutes of work to do, you know, to write up, to do the report before heading home. You had to think that was a good trip based on there not being a whole lot going on before you went out there.
Well, you know, I think you'll find this interesting because Tyson had kind of like an ongoing feud with a couple of the American writers, and they were having two press conferences a day in the lead up to the fight. He had a press conference with the British writers, all of whom he apparently liked and had a good relationship with. And then he had a press conference with the American fighters, some of whom he didn't get along with. And he was like, you know, surly and giving one word answers and so on and so forth. So the British guys were getting better stuff. So after a day or two of this and hearing what the British guys were getting, I said, to hell with this. I'm going to pledge allegiance to Queen Elizabeth. And I went to I started going to the British press conference, and Tyson and King knew who I was, and they knew I wasn't British. I tried to ask it in a foul British accent, you know. And Tyson was laughing, and King was laughing, and the only thing that I established was that, you know, that I'm not Meryl Streep when it comes to, you know, using foreign, you know, different accents. My fake British accent really did not go over well, but it did provide a certain amount of humor to the people that were there. I can't remember what the question was, but it did draw a lot of laughs. I mean, my imitation of Rodney Dangerfield or something.
But you went over there assuming it was going to be a mismatch, though, surely.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and of course, but once again, Muhammad Ali had a certain amount of mismatches too. You know, when he's fighting Richard Dunn, you know, nobody expects Richard Dunn to win, but once again, he's Muhammad Ali. So whether or not it was going to be a one round fight or what it turned out to be, you had to be there. And of course, you know, the thing is there were indications ahead of time that maybe they might be something a little bit different. Because a lot of people figured that Buster Douglas actually had some talent. He just wasn't in shape a lot of times and, you know, didn't prepare and his mind wasn't where it needed to be. But we all knew ahead of time, you know, his mother had just died and he had dedicated, you know, that fight to his mom and so on and so forth. So, you know, there was at least a chance, you know, that that if he did something that was better than expected because of dedicating the fight to his mother, you know, that it might turn out to be something better than we all anticipated. And I tell you what, 2-3 rounds into the fight, it became apparent, you know, to all of us, you know, that, hey, what's happening? And it was certainly something that nobody expected. And it turned out to be one of the greatest stories. And we were all privileged. Those of us who were there were privileged to be there because we knew that we had stumbled into something really terrific.
And I suppose, and I don't know what you think about this from a fighter's perspective, but people say that he'd look for an easy way out against Tony Tucker. And in my experience, anyone who's been dubbed a quitter or labeled a quitter before, it's not, and that's not a label I like to use, but it's not a case of once a quitter, always a quitter. Someone who's quit lives with so much guilt that they want to prove that they're not a quitter again. And obviously, who better for Douglas to prove his psychological strength against than the guy that was freaking out the rest of the heavyweight division?
Yeah, the thing is that fighters often complain about this with certain writers. You know, if a writer puts this guy's a bum or he's a tomato can or he's a quitter or something like that, he's just an opponent. If the fighter can say, hey, the guy who's saying this or the person who's writing this has never been in the ring. There's some legitimacy to that because, you know, unless you've been there, it's really difficult to try to throw that at somebody. You know, look at a fighter as great as Roberto Duran. I mean, it took him years to try to live down, you know, the No Mas fight. And I don't know that nobody's judging Roberto Duran's entire career because of the second Leonard fight. And Eric had some other fights where, you know, he gained 40 pounds between fights and he didn't come down the way that he did. But you have to look at things in perspective, you know, I'm not really sure. I mean, no matter what happens with Buster Douglas, nobody can take away Tokyo from him, you know, I think at this particular point, if you say, yeah, but what about the Tony Tucker fight? Well, I think one more than balances out the other, you know, but I've never liked the idea of putting one of those uncomplimentary labels on a fighter, you know, it just does not sit well with me.
That might be one of the reasons why you're on your way into Canastota. Talking of fighters with bundles of heart, you had the privilege of covering a very decorated former Olympian out of Philadelphia, Meldrick Taylor, who must have given you some of your most fantastic ringside memories, surely.
I don't know if you saw the Legendary Nights.
The tale of
Chavez Taylor, and I was one of the talking heads for that. And one of the things that I said was that Meldrick Taylor. I mean, they had a clip of Meldrick before the Chavez fight, talking about what he hoped would happen in his career, and then they had another clip of him with the speech slurred and so on and so forth. And I said, you know, Meldrick Taylor was a special talent. He really was. I mean, you take Floyd Mayweather or Roy Jones or whoever you want to, I mean, who are guys with fast hands, blurringly fast hands. And I still maintain that at his best, Meldrick Taylor had the fastest hands of any fighter I've ever seen. And what happened to him after the Chavez fight, the first Chavez fight, probably would have happened to him anyway. The problem that I had was, you know, the stoppage with 2 seconds to go. And I'll tell you why. I was there for the first fight between Tommy Hearns and Iron Barkley. And when Iron Barkley nailed Tommy was on, you know, he was out on his feet. His legs were wobbly, you know, and there was a lot of time left in the round. And Richard Green is looking, and he's waiting. And finally he had to stop the fight. And he got asked the question, why didn't you stop the fight earlier? Because, you know, Tommy was defenseless. And he said, Tommy is a great champion. And great champions deserve their opportunity to fight their way out of trouble. Well, in a fight that Meldrick had won on the scorecards, he was, you know, it was too far ahead on two of the scorecards, you know, to lose the fight. You know, Richard stopped the fight with 2 seconds to go. Now, two things about that. Number one was that Chavez knew that there was only a couple seconds left because of the red light that was in the corner that was flashing, you know. Richard had to see that. Certainly Chavez saw it, and Chavez was up on Richard's shoulder. You know, he was ready to run around and try to get another shot. If Richard had turned him, say, go back to the neutral corner, which he should have done, the fight's over, and Meldrick wins the decision. And he had, no matter what, he has that victory over Chavez. Plus, Richard sees the light flash, and he has to know it's only 2 seconds later. So he gets asked later, why did you stop the fight? And he said, I don't care if it's a four-round fighter or a world champion. If I think he's in trouble, I'm stopping the fight. And my response was, you didn't say that for Tommy Hearns and Iran Barkley. You know what I mean? So you can't have it one way and not the other. And so my feeling was, and I'm not the only one that thinks this, and I know the people that feel the other way, that the first person to actually defeat Julio Cesar Chavez probably was Mildred Taylor. And if it wasn't Mildred Taylor, it certainly was Colonel Whitaker, because that draw was ridiculous. Officially, that's not the case. But, and look, this is nothing against Julio Cesar Chavez, because he's a great fighter and, you know, and nothing can take away from that. But I do think, you know, that Meldrick, he was still going to wind up, you know, the way that he was physically and impaired. But I do believe, and I will believe to go to the grave, you know, that he should have got that victory against Chavez in the first fight.
So I remember interviewing Richard Steele years later, and he stood by it. There is that old adage, Bernard, that better a second too early than a second too late.
Yeah, but once again,
it could have, because one punch changes everything. I mean, we're speculating, aren't we? We're being armchair referees. It's so difficult, isn't it?
But yeah, but the thing is that you see this how many times that, you know, a fighter's got another fighter hurt and in trouble, you know, and they leave the neutral corner, you know, and they want to come up there. They come up, they're trying to sneak up and everything like that. Richard had to know that Chavez was like right there next to him, you know, or right on his shoulder. He wants to run around, you know, because he's only got a couple of seconds left. What Richard should have done, this is in my opinion, was he says, you have to go back to the neutral corner. As soon as he turns around and points to the neutral corner, because, you know, you're not supposed to be like right up on Richard's shoulder, the fight's over. I mean, you know, that was my standpoint. And plus the fact, you know, look, you could point to Lou Duva. Lou Duva shouldn't have got up on the ring apron or something like that, yelling instructions to Meldrick, and, you know, and he looked over there. There's a lot of things that went into that, you know, but stop and think about this. That fight was 6 weeks after Tyson Douglas. And that was the Ring Magazine's fight of the year, Chavez and Taylor. Mm. How great was that fight that it topped Tyson and Douglas, you know, for fight of the year? That's amazing.
And I mean, tell me, what's your answer to this? Did that break Meldrick more physically or mentally, that fight, and what happened?
I think both. He was never the same. And, you know, some people have written about this, and it's true. Meldrick Taylor, who is still a very young fighter and a tremendously gifted fighter, had his prime beaten out of him in one fight. Now, one thing I you can say, because not all fighters take punishment the same way. He had hit everything. I mean, everything but, you know, the proverbial kitchen sink he had hit Chavez with. But one thing you have to say about Julio Cesar Chavez, I think they actually did something where they found out that the skull was like a quarter inch thicker than the average skull or something. That, I mean, but he did not get noticeably damaged in that fight. He got hit with, you know, tons of punches. And Meldrick probably incorrectly, I mean, probably the wiser thing would have been for him to try to box more, but he decided that he was going to engage Chavez at close quarters. And he was winning a lot of those exchanges, but he was taking punishment. And if there's one thing that Chavez could do, he could hurt you. He could hurt you to the body. He could hurt you upstairs. You know, Meldrick like ingested like nearly a pint of his own blood, you know, from cuts in his mouth. And, you know, it was never the same after that, but it was a shame, you know. And my relationship with him actually kind of took a bad turn when he went to London, lost, and you know, the world title he'd won from Aaron Davis against Chris Santo Espana on the undercard of the Razor Ruddock Lennox Lewis fight. And Lou Duva and George Menton both advised him to retire. And I wrote that they had advised Meldrick to retire. And Meldrick didn't like that, you know, and so he didn't want to speak with me. And he had two attorneys, and they wanted to broker a deal where, you know, we patched our differences. So I had a meeting with him, and Meldrick said, you know, I'm a Philadelphia fighter, and you're a Philadelphia writer, so you should write more good things about me. I said, Meldrick, I've written a lot of good things about you. I said, but this is the deal. You know, I'm writing for the Philadelphia Daily News and readers of the Philadelphia Daily News. I said, I'm not your press agent. You know, I mean, I'm not your publicist. I said, and this is how it works. I said, you fight them good, I write about you good. And you fight them bad, I got to write about that too. You know, and it's amazing how many fighters don't understand the relationship between the media and themselves. You know, you could write a dozen good stories about a fighter who earns that good press. And then if you write something they don't like, then all of a sudden you're the enemy. But the fact of the matter is that your job is basically to report what you're seeing, you know, and not everybody understands that.
About just while we're on Meldrick, I remember you know, when we spoke, because I sat next to you ringside for Baterbia Vozdik last year, or was it 2 years ago now? God, I don't know. With COVID, it's messed everything up. But we sat, you were saying about Meldrick then, and he ransacked his annuity, didn't he? He had like a pension fund that should have kept him safe and living well into retirement.
Yeah, because you know, Top Rank, you know, basically their people said, you know, like, we're going to set something up and we're going to put this money in. And then when you get to a certain age, you'll be able to live comfortably for the rest of your life, you know? And Meldrick, a lot of these guys, they probably spend above their means. And he wanted to basically, you know, take all the money out of the annuity, which he did. And so therefore, you know, when he went through that, then he had nothing else to fall back on. And there was an HBO special, ESPN special, Broke, about all these famous football, basketball players, boxers. We all know the story about Evander Holyfield and his mansion in Georgia, you know, that had bowling alley and the theater. And it was all predicated on he was making $20 billion a fight. Well, you know, when that ceased, and the other thing, of course, we had a bunch of children that he had to pay child support for. The cost of keeping is however many million that you made in boxing, it's not going to last forever. And you know, it happens, you know, and I just wish that some of these guys, they can realize that, you know, it's not a cash spigot that's going to flow forever and doesn't always happen.
Let me ask
you. That's what makes Bernard Hopkins a little different, because, you know, some of the guys would come and say, hey, B-Hop, can you loan me $50,000, you know, or something? He says, okay, what sort of collateral do you have? You know, and they go, collateral, you know, and he didn't care if he grew up with you. You know, I mean, you had to be able to show that you could pay him back, you know, and he was wise with his money. He didn't make a whole lot of friends that way, you know, but he was smart with his money. Not everybody is.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to B-Hop, but I did have a question about, you know, obviously being on the Philly beat, the icons of Philly really for me are Smoking Joe Frazier and Benny Briscoe. And obviously I know that you came after them, but did your paths cross with Smoking Joe and Briscoe at all?
Yeah, I mean, matter of fact, I was around Benny a lot. You know, I mean, obviously this was after his career was over, and I was around the Frazier family a lot. Man, you know, Jackie, Marvis, you know, and the thing is, there I am in Philly. I'm the Philly boxing writer. And so I was at Joe's gym on North Broad Street a lot. And I was around them, you know. I was around, you know, Val Avery, you know, who was, you know, his chief trainer at the gym. And matter of fact, Jackie Frazier, after Layla Lee turned pro, and she had that her first fight against April Fowler, I said, "What do you think of Muhammad Ali's daughter turning pro?" And Jackie, who had been a basketball player and an athlete at American University in Washington, she says, "This and this and this." She says, "You know, if I took time to train, I could kick her ass." And then she says, "Matter of fact, I think I will kick her ass." You know, and so the next day she started training at her dad's gym, and like a year and a half later, or whatever it was, you know, they're fighting in Verona, New York, and so Jackie was telling everybody, he says, "This fight is happening because of Bernard Fernandez," you know, and assigned to that fight, and weren't maybe big on women's boxing. They said, "So you're the one who's responsible for this?" I said, "Yeah, I guess." But Joe was there, and Ali was there too, you know, and I got to know both of them pretty well.
What was Benny Briscoe like?
You know, Benny was a quiet, you know, he looked a lot like Marvin. You know, he had the shaved skull, the scowl, you know, I mean, you know, he intimidated more than a few people in the same way that Marvin did, you know, because he looked like he could kick butt and he did. But he was a very private person, you know, and after boxing, he went to work for the city of Philadelphia. And I hate to say this because it sounds terrible for somebody that accomplished as much as he did, three times for the middleweight championship, but he was in rat control. I mean, basically he was, you know, in the business of exterminating rats for the city, you know, and which seems like really a kind of a demeaning thing for him to be doing after the career that it had, you know, but, John DeSanto, who is the curator of the Philly Boxing History website, he created something called the Benny Briscoe Award, which is about this big. And every year when he has his Philadelphia Boxing Awards, the Philadelphia Boxer of the Year gets the Benny Briscoe Award. So, which was created by a sculptor, Carl Lavach, who does a lot of the awards for the Boxing Writers Association of America. And, you know, so it's good, you know, that Benny lives on in the form of this award that goes every year to the Philadelphia Boxer of the Year.
Of course. And from one middleweight to another, you obviously mentioned earlier Hopkins. You must have had many a long conversation with Hopkins over the years and covered basically his entire career, I guess.
Yeah, I was there for his pro debut, the 4-round loss to Clinton Mitchell. But like I tell people, when you work for a newspaper, they give you a certain news hole to do the story. And the main event that night was John Wesley Meekins against Saul Mombi. And so, you know, I called my office and said, "Well, how long a story do you want?" They said, "We want 14 inches or 12 inches or 14 inches, well, I think it was." So by the time I did the lead on the Meekins Mombi fight, I'm like 11 or 12 inches into the story. And then I did like the top one or two undercard bouts, and Bernard Hopkins is fighting in a 4-rounder down at the, you know, the beginning of the program or something. So I said, "Yep, I was there for Bernard Hopkins' first fight. I was there for his last fight against Joe Smith, and for most of the fights in between." But for his pro debut against Clinton Mitchell, that didn't get into my story. But I was there, but I didn't get a chance to actually have it get it into the paper.
Do you have any memories of any great conversations you've had with Bernard over the years?
Oh, many. I mean, you know, the thing is, our relationship is such, and of course, we both have the same first name. So you know, basketball stars, Will Chamberlain and Bill Russell, they had pet names for each other. Bill Russell's full name was William Felton Russell, and it was Wilton Norman Chamberlain. So when one would call the other, they would say, "Hey, Wilton, this is Felton," you know, and or excuse me, Norman, this is Felton. And so whenever I would try to get in touch with Bernard Hopkins, I'd get his voicemail or something. He would call me back and say, "Hey, Bernard, this is the other Bernard," you know, and so each of us, you know, would address each other like that. But he's expansive type of talker. So I would ask him a question and he would go on for like 8 minutes. And somewhere in that 8 minutes, there would be a golden nugget of a quote. I didn't use all 8 minutes. I might use 30 seconds or, you know, from the 8 minutes or something. But, you know, and that's what I would tell people. I said, you know, he really is a good storyteller, but he doesn't really know how to condense it real well, you know. And that was going to be a problem if he was going to be a commentator. But I'd ask him a question. I'd ask him like 6-7 questions, and I'd get 45 minutes of tape, and there would be like 5 or 6 golden nuggets in there. I just had a pan for him, you know, because he had this stream of consciousness sort of pattern, you know, where he would just start off and go off on a tangent and so on and so forth. But I'm real fortunate. You know, we've had this good relationship that's gone on for, God, 30 plus years, you know, and he always understood that when I had to, you know, unlike some fighters, if I had to write something that was critical, he understand I was just doing my job, you know, didn't hold it against me.
What's made him different? Why is he such a good talker? Why is he such a good thinker? Why is he so open to criticism? Why does he stand out from the crowd? What's in him?
Well, you know, one thing, as the executioner, you know, which was his nickname in early in his career, if you look at his record, there's a lot of like 1-round, 2-round knockouts, you know, and so he was a banger, you know, and he was on his way to entering, you know, Matthew Saad Muhammad territory, you know. And then one of the things that he learned, I don't know how much of a hand Bowie Fischer had in this or whatever, was that fighters like that, like the Arturo Gattis and the Saad Muhammads or something like that, you know, they're entertaining, but they don't necessarily have a lot of longevity. And I think Bernard Hopkins decided that his best chance to become a champion and to stay there was to have some longevity. And to have that longevity, he was going to make alterations in his style. And it became more of still entertaining in his way, but more of a technician, you know what I mean? And he didn't take a whole lot of punishment in most of his fights. And that's why he was able to be as good as he was for as long as he was. That's pretty smart.
I'm sure you were at Madison Square Garden for the Trinidad fight, right?
Yes. So, oh, yes.
So I mean,
his greatest performance.
Yeah, I mean, I was at that fight, and I'm obviously not American, but it was in the wake of 9/11, and I was overwhelmed by the sense of patriotism in the building and everything else. I mean, it seemed to be that it was written that Hopkins would win based on what was going on in America. What was it like, A, being close to Hopkins around that fight, and B, what are your memories of that night in the Garden?
Well, if you remember, that fight was delayed 2 weeks because of 9/11. But there was still a lot of, you know, concern about what was happening. I'm not really sure. I mean, once again, there's Madison Square Garden, and there's a huge Puerto Rican population in the New York area. So I'm not really sure how many people in the audience, in the live audience, were for Hopkins. I mean, that, you know, Trinidad had a lot of support. But one of the things that you also remember was that in the lead up, the run up to the event, both in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and in New York, Hopkins grabbed the Puerto Rican flag and threw it down. Not a good idea in San Juan, because like there was a crowd that was really like chasing him, you know, like, you know, I think they wanted to do damage to him before the fight. But what it did, and Hopkins was a master of mind games. What it did was it got Felix Trinidad like so crazy that he wanted to kill Hopkins, you know, and so from the opening bell, he was like, you know, he wanted to just bomb him out of there. And that kind of played into the Hopkins's hands. You know, I mean, he was able to do what he wanted to do a little bit better because, you know, and Trinidad wasn't the only guy that he did that with. I mean, you know, he usually got a lot of fighters off of their game, you know, with some comment or some put down, you know, not as profane as we saw in the lead up to the, Floyd Mayweather, Conor McGregor, you know, where F-bombs were flying pretty fast. He wouldn't do that, you know, but he would find a way, you know, to get under the other guy's skin, you know, and he was a master at that, you know, and that was part of what made him so good, you know, and he did it for 28 years. How many fighters are still fighting at a high level? When he lost to Joe Smith Jr., he was like a week and a half, 2 weeks from his 52nd birthday. 52, and he's still fighting at that level. I mean, the mind boggles.
Do you have a go-to list of the best fights and fighters that you've seen over the years?
Well, obviously, the first Chavez Taylor fight, and you know, Tyson Douglas is on the list of any great fights that I've seen. There's the trilogy with Arturo Gatti and Mickey Ward, but also Arturo Gatti's two fights with Ivan Robinson, which were incredible. And then there was the 2005 fight with Castillo and Corrales, you know, which is an all-time type of fight. And, you know, those would probably be at the top of my personal list of favorite fights to cover, you know, because they almost wrote themselves, you know, and you really didn't have to stretch very far to find something really good to write about, you know, and not only that, but when you came away from it saying, my God, I'm glad that I covered boxing.
Yeah. Are there any fighters, obviously you mentioned that you've been quite close to Hopkins. Are there any other fighters that you've been close to that you've really enjoyed dealing with that you can remember some good times where you spent with them and they've just been really open and you've had as much time as you wanted with them?
Well, I'm going to throw out two names that might surprise you a little bit that I always enjoyed dealing with. Rock and Rodney Moore, who fought three times for world titles, lost all three, but he was in 26 main events at the Blue Horizon, you know, and was the erstwhile king of the Blue Horizon. But he was a really good interview, you know, and for a Philly guy, you know, and I was writing about him a lot because he was fighting so often in Philadelphia. Sharp guy, good interview. And then Tony Thornton, who fought Roy Jones for the championship, he was the punching postman. By day, he was a letter carrier for the U.S. Postal Service. But he was such a great interview because you'd ask him a question. Instead of just blurting something off the top of his head, he would stop for a second or two and think about what it looked like in print. And he would give such a great response, you know. Some of the best quotes I ever got were from Tony Thornton fights. And I mean, these weren't like huge headlining fights. So I remember one time I was out in Vegas with several other, you know, boxing writers. And, you know, there was a meeting with some of the HBO people, you know, and they said, Lennox, well, this is before Lennox Lewis, but I think George Foreman was going to stop being, you know, the celebrity color analyst for HBO Boxing. And he said, Does anybody have any ideas on who might be a good replacement? And I said, Rodney Moore and Tony Thornton. I mean, because they were such good talkers and good analysts and everything. And this was like saying, well, you know, Harpo Marx would be good or something. That they would, you know, the HBO people gave no credence to it, you know. But I was referring to them because they were such good analysts of boxing. They weren't the best fighters or something, but of course, you know, they wanted a bigger name, and so you look at the people that were, you know, so in that position for HBO, you know, and Lennox got a gig. I mean, Ray Leonard for a time got a, you know, they wanted a big name, you know, and they weren't big names, but I stood by, you know, I thought they would have been good. I mean, I think they would have drawn approval from viewers had they actually had a chance to be on some telecasts, you know, and show what they knew.
Yeah, you're right. I've been privy to some of those TV meetings before where they've been talking about different color analysts. And if you don't have a strap line that says former world champion, then you're hardly in the pecking order at all.
Yeah, that's it. You know, and it's TV, you know, TV, well, you know, they have, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that, you know, and you got to be a celebrity, you know, the biggest celebrity. Look, when you know, and now this is American football and you're, you know, but two of the worst analysts they ever had on television, Johnny Unitas was a horrible analyst, you know, and Joe Namath wasn't real good. They got hired to do that because they were these famous quarterbacks, but they were terrible in the booth, you know. Just because you're a great champion doesn't that mean you're going to be a great television analyst for boxing, you know.
No, of course, of course. And I know, although we touched upon you and Meldrick having a falling out, we've touched upon a lot of the highs and the great fights and so forth, but there must have been other guys that you've crossed swords with in the past. Who else have you fallen out with? Who's on the Fernandez hit list, or has been, that, you know, that's resulted in you guys having a fallout, albeit one that you might have patched up?
I'm highly appreciative of Floyd Mayweather as a fighter. I mean, obviously a great, great fighter, but I was critical of the lead in the was three city, was it three or four cities, for the Mayweather Conor McGregor, you know, because I said, you know, this was, you know, they'd get there and they'd insult one another, which is okay, but you know, they couldn't insult each other without, you know, just flinging F-bombs left and right, you know, and apparently, you know, I saw the press conference and or the gathering in Toronto, and people were eating this up with a spoon, you know, and I just put, you know, that it was crass. And you know, and one time when Floyd got the Fighter of the Year award from the Boxing Writers Association of America, you know, they had a lot of other award winners, and people were told, you know, you need to limit your remarks to like 3 minutes. And he went up there and spoke for like half an hour. And he got up there, and the first thing he said was, you know, I don't like to talk about how rich I am, but by the way, let me tell you how rich I am, you know. And, you know, it gets a little old, you know, and so, all right, don't tell me how rich you are. Tell me about how well you box. Tell me about this upcoming opponent or the guy you just fought, you know. And at some point, you know, money, and then he changed his nickname to money. Sometimes, you know, money overrides everything else in boxing, you know, and like this Anthony Joshua Tyson Fury. $150 million site fee for Saudi Arabia. Well, what's the story now? The story is how much money it's going to generate. What was the main story for, you know, for Pacquiao and Mayweather? How much money it's going to generate, you know? And Let's talk about the boxing. You know, I mean, don't you get tired of that? You know, when everything is just about the financial aspects of the fight, it makes me crazy.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why I do this podcast and Boxing Life Stories, because I want to talk about life stories. And you know that as well as I do, this sport has got some of the most interesting characters and people in it. And it's a complete throwaway just to be talking about how many zeros a fighter's got, because ultimately, you know, you can talk about all the zeros that Mayweather Pacquiao got, but it was still a far better fight 5 years before it actually happened.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, I don't know if you saw the my first anthology, Championship Rounds.
Yeah.
But some of the stories that I like best, and I think people who read the book liked, there was a story about the Sean Nagler, the kid, you know, with cancer, who was a huge Bernard Hopkins fan. And, you know, he got to meet Bernard Hopkins through the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And, he was very ill. He was on the verge of dying, and his parents carried him up to the bedroom to watch the Hopkins, Kelly Pavlik fight. And, you know, like, he lapsed into a coma shortly after and died. That's a human interest story. It's a story about Bernard Hopkins that not many people were aware of. The first story in the book was about the very unusual background of referee Mills Lane. Did another story on Craig Bojanowski, the fighter who had a prosthesis after one of his legs was amputated below the knee after being in a motorcycle accident, and he went on to fight Robert Daniels for a cruiserweight championship. And another story that I did on Seamus McDonough, who got knocked out by Evander Holyfield in Holyfield's last fight before he fought Buster Douglas. You know, these are guys who kind of were beneath the radar or off the radar or something, but they had great human interest stories. And, you know, you're a terrific writer. I mean, when you come across a story like that, that goes beyond just the obvious in boxing, you know, when you're writing about people and what their lives are like and so on and so forth, you know, and there's a lot of the stories out there. People just have to look a little harder to find them, you know, and when you do write them, they can touch something in you, you know, that resonates.
Sure. You also said, Bernard, but going back right to the start here, that about Hopkins, and you said about some more difficult stories you've had and all the rest of it. I'm guessing that you were pretty torn in between both camps when he split up with Bowie Fischer, because you would have been right in the middle of all of that.
Yeah. You know, because the thing is that Bowie treated Bernard Hopkins like one of his sons, and he had this relationship that was almost like familial. And then something would come up, and as is often the case, it was some of the friction between them was over money, over what Bowie felt that he was owed, you know, for certain fights, and they broke up and they came back together and they broke up again. And Angelo Dundee wasn't with Ray Leonard towards the back end of his career over money, you know. And the thing is that it always is sad to me when you have people that have, like, a boxer and a trainer that have that kind of relationship, or could be, maybe it's a boxer and a manager, a boxer and a promoter, that they have that type of relationship, and something comes up that fractures the relationship. And usually it has something to do with money. And, you can argue left and right who's to blame or who's more to blame. But I hate the special relationships that everybody can feel good about end, you know, over, you know, who deserves a few more dollars or, you know, whatever. And that's often the case, you know. Money's the great divider, I mean, in a lot of cases. I couldn't believe when Ray Leonard let Angelo Dundee go, you know, over compensation. You know, I mean, you'd figure that was a relationship that would last forever, you know, and didn't.
Yeah, boxing shows that nothing, you know, God, they say blood is thicker than water, but nothing's thicker than money.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the thing is that when like a guy like Floyd or stuff like that, I always said, you know, what happened, and maybe you would think this too, if I accidentally won, you know, the Powerball lottery, and somebody called and said, okay, you just won $400 million, you know, would it change me? I mean, you know, it changes a lot of people, and really in boxing. You have people, a lot of people that are fighters, really terrific fighters that come from impoverished circumstances, you know, that you know, it's got to be a huge lifestyle change all of a sudden to be in the position that they're now in, you know, and I've seen it change people, you know, I mean, they're not the same person that they were. Maybe it affects them in the ring, maybe it doesn't, you know, but it can lead to changes in their relationships with other people, you know, or how they conduct themselves personally, you know, and so maybe it's a good thing that I've never won a lottery, which I'm never going to do because I don't actually buy the tickets.
You said that very sort of reluctantly and with a sort of grave acceptance that your numbers just haven't come up.
Yeah, just tell Doug Fisher to pay me more money for my stories. You know, that'll make me happy.
Yeah, I'll tag
you. No, I'm very happy with Ring.
And just in closing, Bernard, obviously you mentioned the championship rounds, one that's out now and two and three that are on the way, which is great. For many, you have been a go-to writer for people over the last three decades or more. Who are your go-to writers? Who are the ones that you've always looked forward to reading? Say Tyson's fighting this week. Who you know, not now, but back in the day, 1990, Mike Tyson's fighting. Who would you pick up and read?
Well, and you know, I have a long-time friendship with Ron Borges. You know, like nowadays, I like to read Springs Toledo. Anything that Dave Kindred ever wrote, John Shulian, you know, I had a great relationship with Ed Schuyler, you know, I mean, who was a legendary guy, had been to every fight, major fight since Cain and Abel, you know, Bert Sugar. And the great thing about being a boxing writer is you would go to a major fight, and there would be this fraternity of guys that were like at most of the big fights, and you got close, you know, and in some cases it was a little competitive because you're writing for your media outlet and some, you know, but, for the most part, you know, you would get past that. And, I have a great respect and affinity for people that do what we do, you know, because I know how difficult it can be. There are a lot of benefits and advantages and things that you take away from it that are enjoyable. But there are times, you know, that, I've been, you know, called away, you know, I have to leave in an hour and a half or something. I remember another time that I had to, tell my wife that 2 days before Christmas, I got to leave on Christmas morning because, you know, this was for a basketball tournament in Seattle, but, it's not all peaches and cream being a sports writer, but I tell you what, it's a job that I would not have traded for anything else. You know, I'm sure that there are days when you wake up and you just say, I can't believe that I'm getting paid to do what I do, you know?
No, yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, hey, I always say that. And I think having had the experience of some very bad jobs, menial jobs back in the day, then obviously I have an added appreciation for what I do now. And obviously being able to speak to people like you, Bernard, a Hall of Famer. And it's great. I'm very much excited to go there. It's not going to be this June, is it? But next June, and I'll be there. And hopefully we'll be able to do one of these in person because it will be 3 years in the making by the time you eventually get there.
Yeah, that's one of the things about, you know, like movies from like the 1960s, Lawrence of Arabia, something like that. That's what they would say. 3 years in the making, you know, and cast of thousands.
Well, hey, I tell you what, there will be a cast of thousands. There's three classes going in.
Three classes going in. Yeah, I've been, and what I'm hearing is that, you know, maybe one class will go on Friday and the other one will go on Saturday and the third one will go on a Sunday or something. So it'll stagger it a little bit because I don't think they have a stage big enough to put all three classes on there at the same time, you know, but, you know, I understand that, that most people that are there because of the fighters, but they got some writers that are going in too, you know, and I'm, you know, like, Tom Hauser is in the class of 2020 also, you know, and I've known him for a long time, you know, and he went authored 37 books, you know, so he's got a body of work that's pretty impressive. And so, you know, boxing is about fights and fighters first, but it's also about fights and writers, you know, too. So I'm glad to be part of that side of it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think so. So I've had David Diamante, the ring announcer, on this podcast recently, and he's very good when he talks about the boxing fraternity, because it's true. When you go to, you know, if you go to, well, the Blue Horizon as it was, or you go to Atlantic City, you see the same guys setting up the ring. You see the same guys announcing. You see the same judges. You see the same faces. You see some of the same people in the crowd, and you all become... And then obviously you see your colleagues on press row and you see the cut men and the house seconds. It becomes a very close fraternity if you see these people week in, week out over a period of years.
You know, one thing, when you do it for a really long time, I remember when I was the hard charging young sports writer, and one of the things, to use a Star Wars reference, I said, you know, I used to be Luke Skywalker. One day I woke up, I was Yoda. You know, and
do you know what? It's funny you should say that. I remember being that much of a hardcore boxing nerd that I would go to boxing fights and I'd see these top journalists, you know, people like yourself and legends, and you'd be talking about baseball or football, and I'd be like, you're a boxing journalist, talk about boxing. This is what we're all here for. And obviously now I have that perspective on life. You know, last thing I want to be doing is chatting to talking shop about boxing with boxing people when you can talk about their real lives and the stuff that actually means, you know, that means you know, that changes their day rather than what they talk about on the job.
Yeah, well, you know, but you can't escape it for long. You mean, you might want to talk about what's happening at home or something like that, but sooner or later it's always going to get back to the boxing.
Yeah, it does. It always comes back to this. But it's great. In fact, there's one last thing I wanted to ask you before I let you go, Bernard, and it was this. I went to Philadelphia a couple of years ago. Joe's gym is now a furniture store. The Blue Horizon shut and it was all boarded up. They've obviously still got the mural on the side. A few of the gyms I've been to in the old days are gone. Since I've been out there and interviewed people like Harold Johnson and Jimmy Young, they've both gone. Matthew's gone. Jeff's moved out of town. I think Bernard lives in Delaware, if I'm not wrong. Yep. And it just seems that Philadelphia, this great fight town, is gradually closing down. Is it, or is it still open for business?
Not to the extent that it was. And, you know, one of the things that that I kind of miss about it was there was a time, and you know this as well as I do, you know, like we just had the Navarrete fight with the other night, and a Puerto Rican fighter and a Mexican fighter. So areas, well, it's Puerto Rico versus Mexico, so, you know, it's got to be a great fight. Well, when you mentioned Philadelphia, for a long time, years, decades, well, you said, well, you know, Philadelphia fighter is somebody that comes out of the womb throwing left hooks, you know. And if you said it's a Philadelphia fighter against a Mexican fighter, it was, you know, you kind of had an idea what it was going to be, because a Philadelphia fighter had a certain identity, just like Mexican fighters have a certain identity. And I think Philadelphia is losing a little bit, you know, because not producing as many great fighters as it has. I mean, still to a certain degree, you know, but and that saddens me a little bit, because when I went on the beat in Philadelphia, I was glad to be in a great fight town, but I knew that I was going to have tons of stuff to write about, because so many great fighters had been produced in Philadelphia, and I presumed that the spigot would be turned on forever, you know, I mean, and it would always be that way. But, you know, unfortunately, tradition is a perishable commodity, and it doesn't last forever, you know, and you can only ride the momentum of years past for so long, you know, I mean, you've got to keep the pipeline open. And I would like to see Philadelphia come back and be what it was, you know, but we'll see, you know, and I'm still around, you know, and if and when it does happen, hopefully I'll still be here to write about it.
That's brilliant, Bernard. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm really grateful that we've managed to get this done. And I very much hope that I'll be seeing you ringside at another big fight before too long.
Yeah, I hope so too. You know, and, you know, I've always enjoyed being around my British colleagues, you know, and even if I'm not real good at appropriating a British accent at press conferences, which I will never do again.
Ah, that's brilliant. No, thank you so much for your time. I'm grateful as always.
Take care, Chris.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Some great stories there from Bernard. It was a shame that we didn't get to hear his British impression. It would have been interesting, I'm sure. But some great stories in there. Obviously, the Philadelphia stuff is hugely interesting to me as a huge Philadelphia fight fan. Interesting to see and be part of his journey throughout. And obviously, you know, to cover, it shows that you've been in boxing a long time if you cover the length and breadth of Bernard Hopkins' career, as Bernard did. A reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance. They're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. If you've enjoyed this podcast, this recent run, which has been brilliant, including Bernard, obviously David Price, Ryan Burnett and Curtis Woodhouse, and you haven't reviewed this podcast, please go and rate and review this podcast on iTunes and on your podcast provider. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll be back next week.